Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, Chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. Today, our speaker is Bernard Siegel, JD. He is the founder and executive director of the nonprofit Genetics Policy Institute based in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. He is the founder and co-chair of the World Stem Cell Summit series of global conferences and editor-in-chief of the World Stem Cell Report. He also serves as the co-chair of the Governmental Affairs Committee of the International Society for Stem Cell Research. Mr. Siegel is a frequent lecturer, panelist, and keynote speaker on the subject of stem cells and public policy. He has addressed the United Nations, the Salk Institute, James Baker Institute of Public Policy at Rice University, New York Biotechnology Association, Diabetes Research Institute Foundation, Seoul National University, International Stem Cell Forum in Beijing, World Congress for Freedom of Scientific Research in Rome, Stem Cells European Business Summit in Edinburgh, Stem Cells Europe Amsterdam, World Parkinson Congress, Association of American Law Schools, American College of Trial Lawyers, and has spoken at numerous colleges and universities. He is often interviewed on radio and TV. In fact, he was on KGO this morning from 10 to 11. He had quite a few good questions. Mr. Siegel earned his undergraduate and law degrees from the University of Miami with a BA in 1972 and a JD in 1975. He has been a member of the Florida Bar since 1975. So here, Mr. Siegel will discuss Stem Cell Advocacy 2.0, the role of stem cell consumer movement in the Obama era.
Thank you, Bill. Well, the political climate for stem cell research has certainly changed for the better since March 9th, and I think many of us who are stem cell advocates are certainly in a celebratory mood. 6 years ago, I created this nonprofit foundation, the Genetics Policy Institute, with the aim to educate the world, work with the leading stem cell researchers and policymakers for more enlightened policy relating to embryonic stem cell research. Now, through our programs, we are perhaps one of the leading promoters of the entire field of regenerative medicine. The idea that we might be able to use stem cells in regenerative medicine, which rather than using drugs or surgery, might be able to rebuild damaged tissues and organs through cell therapies, a real paradigm shift. Some of the projects we work with or work on include the World Stem Cell Summit. We've worked for 5 years in creating events with major academic institutions, and our upcoming event, September 21st and 23rd, is with Johns Hopkins University and the University System of Maryland, where we expect 1,200 to 1,500 researchers, advocates, legal experts, policymakers to advance this entire field, also industry, because perhaps stem cell research in this new regen industry is the diamond point of innovation in the field of biotechnology and could represent the future of medicine. So, of course, on March 9th, there were people that I've been working with for years as stem cell advocates, and we all watched President Obama come up to the microphone and speak to an audience. And he said, finally, our science policy was going to be based on scientific merit and not ideology. He said that today we honor all those whose names we don't know, who organized and raised awareness and kept on fighting, even when it was too late for them or for the people they love. And we honor those we know who use their influence to help others and bring attention to this cause, people like Christopher and Dana Reeve, who we wish could be here at this moment. I met Christopher and Dana Reeve, and at the very end of my talk, I'm going to show a three-minute video that Christopher Reeve worked with me on and presented to the United Nations. This has been a journey and a half for all of us who are advocates, and I thought I might share with you at the beginning of this little talk about how I became involved in this field myself, which was truly about as unusual, I think, as any narrative you can find. A few years ago, I was helping my daughter, who, on a paper on Dolly the sheep, all right, it was a science project in middle school. Well, I was a practicing trial attorney in Miami, Florida, and you may remember way back in the end of 2002, a group strode to a microphone. A woman with copper hair, very unusual French accent, strode to a microphone at a Holiday Inn in Hollywood, Florida, and announced to a stunned world, "We have done it. We have cloned the first human being." Well, this was Dr. Brigitte Bosselier, and she made this announcement. She didn't even go down the street to the Diplomat at the Holiday Inn, and the world was stunned. She created the first human clone. Did it happen? Was it true? Was it not true? And I remember that paper that I did with help my daughter with, and I knew you couldn't clone a human being safely. Now, this was not just some curious observation on my part. I was a cancer survivor myself. I had colon cancer 11 years ago. And I knew that these people, which were part of a UFO sect called the Raelian Movement, and the so-called human cloning company, CloneAid, had testified in Congress and appeared before the National Academy of Sciences, and somehow were influencing the very debate on stem cell research, and specifically the issue of therapeutic cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer, nuclear transfer. There are half a dozen names for this. No wonder the public is confused. And we're somehow being foisted on the public. This is the same group that had taken $500,000 from a West Virginia couple to clone their deceased child. Here they were making this announcement right in an area where I practice law. So I did a little research and remembered the days when I used to do family law and dependency work. And I knew anyone who's aware of a potentially neglected child or a child in trouble can file a motion for temporary guardian to bring everyone before the court and test the truth of this. So on New Year's Eve 2002, I prepared this petition for temporary guardian, and I thought it might be a footnote in a law journal, the first case to protect the cloned human being. And I filed it with the court, and I went home. And my wife and I are looking at CNN that night, and across the bottom of the ticker, it says, Florida attorney Bernard Siegel seeks custody of cloned baby. My wife turns to me and says, Bernie, what did you do? What happened is I had gotten myself embroiled in a global cause celeb. And a couple of nights later, CNN calls me up and says, Mr. Siegel, Rael, the leader of the Raelian movement that started CloneAid, is saying they're not going to do the DNA test that they promised the world because you're trying to take the baby away from the mother. And a couple of nights after that, I'm debating Rael live on Connie Chung. And Connie Chung asked this fellow, who's dressed in a Star Trek uniform, essentially, she asked the most unbelievable question ever asked on television. She says, Your Holiness, how's the world to think you're anything but a megalomaniac having sex with your followers doing this for publicity? And I think to myself, 5 days ago I was an ordinary lawyer, and now I'm debating a deity on world television related to human cloning. Well, as it turns out, the case had a serious purpose. I served papers. In fact, the vice president of CloneAid was attending an investment conference I found out in Broward County, Florida, to raise money. No SEC filings. I slapped a subpoena on them, and in a half hour, they hired criminal defense attorneys. In a month, I was able to find out and prove through depositions that CloneAid lacked a street address, it lacked a board of directors, and was nothing more than a sham. It was nothing more than a sham. So essentially, the case burst the bubble of cloning hysteria, which was the zeitgeist. That was the worldview in 2002, that human reproductive cloning, something highly unethical and unsafe, was just around the corner. And that fear and panic and lawmakers stampeding legislation, not only to ban reproductive cloning, but there was a political agenda to ban the somatic cell nuclear transfer, therapeutic cloning, which relates to stem cell research. And it was this hysteria that was burst, at least in part, by that cloning case, and two very prominent researchers that I had reached out to, because little did I realize the searing media scrutiny that I was going to face when doing this. I had really put my professional career on the line to make a footnote in a law journal, right? But two scientists, one Dr. Rudolf Janisch at MIT, and the other was Dr. Ian Wilmot, who's the father of Dolly the sheep, said, Bernie, essentially you were the only person to stand up against the cartoon scientists. And when we have our minute on Fox News or CNN or MSNBC, and we're pitted against someone perhaps with a political agenda or a charlatan, how's the world to know the difference between who is legitimate and who isn't? So they said, would you work with us in this field, and we will introduce you to leading researchers from around the planet. Now, this was something very serious, and to me, I take personal narratives seriously. When else was I going to get an opportunity to be able to intervene in a cause, something that I had researched and was very important to me? So I took a leave of absence from my practice of law, and I never went back. I sold my law practice. And in those months after the cloning case, I went to the first meeting of the International Society of Stem Cell Research in Washington. I met with the leaders of the Biotechnology Industry Organization, the heads of the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, JDRF, and other groups in Washington that were lobbying. I even met Leon Cass, who was Dr. Cass was president, head of the President's Council on Bioethics, trying to better understand this issue myself and find out of whether there was a place for me to be involved in this field. And I recruited a leading science advisory board of some of the top stem cell researchers in the world. And today, this organization, the Genetics Policy Institute, boasts close to 100 leading researchers, ethicists, and legal experts with a single mind to move the field of regenerative medicine forward. And what I learned, of course, is that the field of embryonic stem cell research was embroiled in the raging debate of abortion in the United States. This is the thing that really shocked me as a civilian. And the cause that I was fighting for was freedom of scientific research. That was the initial thing that was so important to me. Well, let's talk about the policy. How did this all come about? Why is President Obama's decision in signing this executive order so important? And I'm going to take you back to August 9th, 2001. That's when President Bush had his first address to the American people. And that's when he announced his stem cell policy. Well, his policy at the time was that he was going to allow limited funding from the National Institutes of Health for human embryonic stem cell research on those stem cell lines that were created as of that time and date, which was about 21 stem cell lines made with the technology of the time, grown on mouse feeder cells with animal proteins. And he didn't want any additional funding for stem cell lines after that date because he didn't want to induce or promote researchers to destroy embryos. Well, the existing policy emanates from an obscure rider to the appropriations bill of the Department of Health and Human Services, something known as the Dickey Amendment, named after a social conservative Arkansas former Congressman Jay Dickey, also known as the Dickey-Wicker Amendment. Now, what on earth is the Dickey-Wicker Amendment? Well, that's something that predated President Bush's statement. That was passed in 1996, before human embryonic stem cells were even discovered in 1998 by Dr. Jamie Thompson at the University of Wisconsin. And Dickey-Wicker says that there can be no federal funding from the department, that means the National Institutes of Health, on any research that will harm or destroy an embryo. Okay? That is still the law, and every year it comes up. Every year it's part of an omnibus spending bill, and without debate, it passes. It is sacrosanct. And because of that law, no money can be spent for a researcher to actually derive a human stem cell line. All right, that has to be done with separate private money. Indeed, if your institution uses a pipette that's funded by NIH, you can't use that pipette on deriving a new stem cell line. You need a separate laboratory and separate equipment. And under the Bush administration, there was this fear that if you use that pipette, your entire institution would lose its money. So what happens because of Dickey Wicker, separate laboratories are built, duplicate equipment is purchased, complex bookkeeping systems are created, all because of the Dickey Wicker Amendment. And you will probably be a little displeased to know that the Dickey Wicker Amendment once again was just passed about a week ago without a voice of dissent, once again as part of, the stimulus package, or certainly the funding for the next fiscal year for the Department of Health and Human Services. So President Clinton had come to the point where he was going to send to NIH the rules to allow embryonic stem cell research funding based on only those stem cell lines created without federal funding to begin with. It was President Bush and a lot of his apologists who say, well, he funded this where President Clinton didn't. Actually, he narrowed it. He said, put a hold on NIH creating those rules and regulations, which don't exist to date. In fact, President Obama has just directed NIH to create rules and regulations to govern this field. So President Bush says, we're only going to let you fund those stem cell lines as of that time and date, which essentially is an arbitrary line. And, of course, these cell lines have not proven as robust as we hope. There are many, many, something like 400 stem cell lines around the world that are available, many of them without these animal proteins, some disease-specific, that could be researched right now that are off-limits to federal funding. So that is the background of what has happened to date. And those restrictions are very serious restrictions in the Dickey Wicker Amendment that are still on the books. But there's more than that. If it was just this question of federal funding, it wouldn't be so bad. But the foes of this research were so intent at derailing embryonic stem cell research that they picked on this scary thing about cloning as their hot ticket item. That's where Sam Brownback, the conservative senator from Kansas, proposed something that is known as the Brownback Bill. In Congress, it was the Weldon-Stupak Bill that actually passed the House on several sessions and fortunately wasn't enacted in law. And that is if a researcher was going to do this therapeutic cloning, a form of embryonic stem cell research, he or she could go to jail for 10 years and have $1 million fine. And guess what? If you went overseas and helped your nephew if there was a treatment for diabetes with this in years to come and came back and helped fund it, you could go to jail for 10 years and you could have $1 million fine. And that was the bill that was passed, and President Bush was very supportive of that bill. And the image of scientists going to jail got some of the patient advocates up in arms. In fact, right here in California, some movie producers in Santa Monica, Doug Wick and Lucy Fisher and Jerry and Janet Zucker, formed Cure Now. So they brought in Paul Berg and David Baltimore and prominent scientists to join their board to fight the imposition of the Brownback Bill. That's going to play out a little more in the narrative that I'm telling you now. So where are these ideas dreamed up? Because there are state-by-state fights. In fact, Michigan had one of the strongest pieces of legislation against this therapeutic cloning. In the United Nations, a venue that I became very involved with, the Bush administration, the Vatican, were promoting a world treaty to ban not only unethical reproductive cloning, but this therapeutic cloning as well. Where was this stuff being dreamed up? Well, if you follow the money, you would find that many of the social conservative think tanks, the American Enterprise Institute, the Family Research Council, part of Focus on the Family, James Dobson's group, the Discovery Institute that's trying to foist intelligent design or creationism in our schools. These type of think tanks, funded with millions and millions of dollars, many of them having a bioethics agenda, were proposing these types of legislative initiatives, these attacks on funding that were being thumbtacks on the road. If the field of regenerative medicine is an ambulance going down the highway, I think of these people in a truck dumping out thumbtacks, trying to run us off the road. At least that was my perspective. So what happens where you have groups like this, and why are they doing this? My own belief is that at least some of the political leaders of the social conservatives, in their desire to put a dent on Roe versus Wade, which is the, of course, famous Supreme Court case decided in 1974 that allows first trimester abortions in the United States, which is based on a right of privacy, a woman's right of privacy. Well, in trying to derail Roe v. Wade, which has been part of the roiling political debate in the United States, they thought if we can elevate cells in a petri dish, surplus embryos for medical research, and we equate these cells as people, that will somehow convince the public that this research is unethical and somehow dent Roe v. Wade. Now, of course, there are folks with religious views that see these cells in a dish, these embryos, as having an elevated moral status. And this is a serious ethical discussion, which we can talk about in a minute. But that was my perception of where the foes of the research. And every medical association, every disease advocacy organization supported this field of embryonic stem cell research. I couldn't find a single established medical or scientific society opposed to this. Nevertheless, the foes of the research created talking points and arguments against this. And as I emerged as an advocate in this field, I would find myself challenged to debates at universities, on radio, and on television with some of the prominent foes of the research. And I remember a debate I had at a medical school, at the medical school at the University of Michigan, against a fellow, Dr. David Prentice of the Family Research Council. And Dr. Prentice, who considers himself an expert on adult stem cells, and adult stem cells are is tremendous value to the work that's being done. But the way the foes of the research were framing the debate, they were presenting adult stem cell research as an alternative. It was using, in debate parlance, a false alternative. So, and Dr. Prentice would throw up a slide, and in the slide, you would see a football scoreboard. Adult stem cells, 72. Embryonic stem cells, 0. As if we're talking about junk science here. Well, how unfair is that? The 72 treatments and implications of cures for adult stem cells would include Parkinson's. Explain that to someone who's suffering from Parkinson's today. In fact, there are about 9, I think, FDA-approved treatments for adult stem cells, and mainly those are related to leukemia and diseases of the blood. There are many clinical trials going forward today in adult stem cells. It's highly promising work. But embryonic stem cell research has only been around since 1998. It's been underfunded tremendously, and it's an unfair comparison. In fact, our very first clinical trial for embryonic stem cell research through Geron Corporation has just been approved. So scientists will tell you, we need to do work with all of the tools available to attack chronic disease. That includes adult stem cells. It includes the gold standard embryonic stem cells and also iPS cells, induced pluripotent cells, and even SCNT, this nuclear transfer therapeutic cloning, which, just to tell you what it is in a simplest fashion, since that is part of the narrative in the war against embryonic stem cell research, they always pick on the cloning issue. If I took one of my 100 trillion body cells, let's say a skin cell, to be born a skin cell and to die a skin cell, and we take a donated egg, removing the DNA, we take my skin cell, put it in the egg, apply electricity or a chemical solution, and we are able to revert that cell, my skin cell, to an embryonic state, it could then turn into any type of tissue in the human body matching my own. That's the theory. That's the theory of that. And the idea is that then we might one day have a toolkit or could study or burden the cell line with a disease and be able to study it. Well, right now, iPS cells have the promise of taking one of those ordinary cells and injecting genetic material in it and inducing it without even the use of an embryo. That's why we're all so excited about that. But that research is just starting. And to be blunt, we need all of these type of cells to study in order to attack disease. What was the reaction to the Brownback Bill, to the Bush Initiative, to the UN Initiative? What has happened is there is a pro-cures movement that has been created. And what do I mean by that? A pro-cures movement is not a political movement. It's a consumer movement, where ordinary citizens, such as myself, civilians, don't look at stem cell research as a public health issue. They see it as a personal health issue, something impacting their lives, the lives of their loved ones, the lives of their friends. That, I would submit to you, is a very powerful movement. That is what is moving this entire field forward. How has it manifest itself? Well, look at Proposition 71 in California, where I think 7 million voters approved this. Who started Proposition 71? It wasn't the researchers. It was civilians. It were the movie producers. It was Bob Klein, someone in the mortgage business in Silicon Valley, parents of kids with diabetes, who put together an initiative that is just breathtaking in scope and got it passed by initiative. Imagine creating a state agency that's going to fund $3 billion of research into this promising field of regenerative medicine. Occasionally online, I hear pot shots and read pot shots on Bob Klein, who heads and is chairman of CIRM. And I have to tell you, I'm a little outraged by that. This is a man that sacrificed several million of dollars of his own money, created essentially an impregnable agency, an agency that could not be ripped apart by politicians in Sacramento, and somehow got this passed. The most challenging work imaginable to create this, with the scientific oversight of giving these grants, the ethical oversight to do it. Then when the social conservative foes dumped out some major boxes of thumbtacks with litigation when they tried to block this from moving forward, rather than being stymied with that, under Bob's leadership, he was able to get bridge loans in the millions of dollars to jumpstart this field. And now, with the state crumbling and not even being able to sell public bonds, using lateral thinking has gotten approval to sell private bonds. And I don't know. I wish I could afford to buy some. I can't. But others may do it. This is dedication, and this is an example of civilians stepping up in a big way, part of a pro-cures movement. And not only do we see this in California, in Michigan and in Missouri, they've also passed initiatives essentially protecting stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, in their state constitutions. Can you imagine making a fundamental right of embryonic stem cell research? In New Jersey, it didn't pass. It was a big funding initiative, but still, hundreds of thousands of people voted for this field to move forward. And private philanthropists have stepped forward in other states in different funding legislation. This is because there has been a vacuum from the federal government and the federal legislation, a real paradigm shift. And don't be surprised, you've heard it here, that this pro-cures movement, this consumer movement, is what is driving the field forward. You might not realize it, but when I hold the World Stem Cell Summit, we have policymakers, governors, and economic developers who see stem cell research as the diamond point, a regen industry, that seeds of innovation that are going to lead us back from this economic recession depression that we are facing. That's going to be a $500 billion industry one day. Not soon, maybe in 20 years, but with breakthroughs and black swans, you never know what's going to happen. We're doing the research, and it's moving forward. And if it wasn't for the great strata of population, the consumers that do it, do you think the politicians would be paying attention? I don't think so. I get frustrated when some of the researchers don't quite understand that these grants that they get are not coming out of thin air. It's from patients in wheelchairs that step forward in the fight. And my journey in this, it's been very interesting in my life and how it's changed my life. Because when I started this, it was all about freedom of scientific research. In fact, I spoke in Rome at the World Congress for Freedom of Scientific Research at the top of the Capitoline Hill overlooking the Forum. I thought the Inquisition was going to seize me. I might be burned at the stake like Bruno or exiled into an excommunicate, although I'm not Catholic. But still, those visions came through my head. It was about freedom of scientific research. But as I became immersed in this field, I became more and more interactive with patients and people afflicted by diseases. And if you're not in the medical or scientific community, you're sort of in a silo. You know what impacts your family, but you might not know what impacts another person. And I was, don't be shocked, my 10th grade biology teacher would really be surprised at what I'm doing now. But I didn't understand diabetes. I thought you had diabetes and you took a shot of insulin. If you had tremors from Parkinson, you took a medication and it would be under control. I didn't get it until I spoke to a parent of a teenager with diabetes who didn't know whether the child had taken his insulin or not when he went to sleep and were up all night worried that the child could go into a diabetic coma. And it was like this every other day, it seemed, what they were going through. Or realize the psychotic side effects that some of the powerful medications and Parkinson's. Or meeting a splendid young woman, Sabrina Cohen, who became a close friend and the first associate director of the Genetics Policy Institute, when I gave a talk at the Miami Project to Cure Paralysis, and I saw a young woman in a wheelchair that looked a little like Sandra Bullock, a pretty young girl who was paralyzed. And I thought to myself, well, what happened to her? And she came up to me and told me that her story, at age 14, she had been injured in an automobile accident and became a quadriplegic, barely could move her arms, yet was the most passionate, optimistic person in this field. What did I know about spinal cord injuries? A few whiplash cases from time to time in my 30 years of trying cases? Now I knew, and I tried to understand. And I became more and more passionate about this and more frustrated at the way the policies were enacted and the lawmakers that were trying to break this field. When President Obama announced his change in policy and lifting the restrictions, I had the privilege of doing several radio interviews. And I confronted the same talking points. I debated a guy on a syndicated show, Lars Larson. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Lars Larson. And Lars attacked me instantly, all these talking points. Well, if this is such a hot field, why doesn't a pharmaceutical company investing in it? Well, Lars, Pfizer is investing $200 million in this. They see embryonic stem cells as a very stable cell, as a tool for drug discovery. Well, why isn't biotechnology doing? Why isn't it the private sector doing? Displaying, I don't want to say ignorance, but let's say a lack of enlightenment on how important fundamental science is and the role of the National Institutes of Health. To paraphrase Irv Weissman at Stanford, the National Institutes of Health funding, it's $28 billion now with a $10 billion stimulus bonus, is perhaps the greatest engine of scientific advancement in the history of man, left largely on the sidelines. But the work of stem cell advocates, I must tell you, is not done today. In fact, our work is only beginning. Because no sooner had this ink on the executive order been signed that the foes of the research, can I say, they went crazy? Tony Perkins, the head of the Family Research Council, says, we're going to go and file legislation in every state, to paraphrase him. They're really behind this embryo personhood initiative, embryo personhood, an embryo in a dish is a person with rights. I think it's unconstitutional. Nevertheless, they tried to pass this in Colorado. Fortunately, it lost. But it's just another thumbtack in the road. When Octomom exploded on the universe, of course, social conservative legislatures tried to regulate that industry, but regulate it in such a way that embryonic stem cell research could not take place in the state. And now proposals just filed in Georgia to restrict nuclear transfer and therapeutic cloning. Well, you know, in Georgia, they're hosting the annual meeting of the Biotechnology Industry Organization, some 10,000 researchers and business people trying to promote that industry. How does that look for the state of Georgia and for economic development? So, how do we defend this work? Should we, as a consumer movement and as stem cell advocates, say, game over, we don't have to worry now. We can stack our rifles. We can go back to our farms. Well, I submit to you that our work is actually beginning. The foes of the research are still absolutely compelled to move forward to restrict this research. There are going to be state-by-state fights. We still need funding of this nascent field. We have fights in many states. We have to continue with this. But there's more to stem cell research than that, and we have to understand that there is a black hole between breakthroughs and the laboratory and translating it into treatments for people. How are we going to do this, and how is it done? It's through private enterprise and investment in companies that are actually going to bring you products. And the challenges of cell therapies, which are a paradigm shift in the way medical treatments are going to be delivered, is going to be a big hurdle. Who's going to be injecting those cells? They're clinicians. The clinicians have to be trained. The clinicians have to work with the companies creating the cells so they have a full understanding on how this is done. This is new and speculative. Is there enough private capital in this time where private capital is headed, has disappeared, where it's all invested in gold? Are they still going to fund these companies? Is that going to prove an insurmountable problem? The biotechnology industry has suggested a proposal I read in the Wall Street Journal that where disease organizations like the Cystic Fibrosis Organization is investing in biotech companies, that NIH should also come in and invest in those companies. There should be a way where these innovative businesses can avoid the black hole, can be funded to the point to see what comes from this. I think that we are going to have to apply lateral thinking, and the ProCures movement is at the vanguard of such thinking. We're going to have input into the issues relating to intellectual property. It has to be balanced. Encourage risk-taking entrepreneurs, but we have to make sure that it's not going to block a broader programs. We're going to have to address the issues of medical tourism. I can't begin to tell you how many times people come up to me and say, Bernie, I want to go to Tijuana. Someone's going to give me an injection of stem cells. What do you think about this treatment in the Ukraine? How about going to China, where there's this a very large biotech company that's working with hospitals? What's and you'll be getting treatments with cord blood. Is it appropriate? Is it safe? Are consumers asking the right questions? Moreover, can we rely on our own broken FDA to move this field forward? It took 8 months of Geron after they submitted a 22,000-page of evidence to get the first clinical trial approved. Are we going to be in a situation where the breakthroughs are going to cure diabetes in mice but take 20 years to come to the American public? And will we have to rely on clinical trials in China and other places to move this field forward? And I submit that that's very likely is going to happen. And the only way this is going to move forward, and if I can use an analogy to the AIDS movement in the United States, this was a group of patients and supporters that would not be denied, that found their voice. So too the pro-cures movement must continue to find a voice to move this forward. Our organization is launching something called the Stem Cell Action Coalition. The Stem Cell Action Coalition, if you go to our website at genpol.org, short for genetics policy, genpol.org, you'll be able to access Stem Cell Action. Sign up. We're trying to aggregate 1 million names to be able to be a voice for stem cell reason and education to be able to move this important agenda forward. And a final important aspect of the agenda is distributive justice. Think about how we are going to deliver this so this only doesn't go to the well-to-do and to the elite, but to the millions of people suffering all over the world. This is not going to be an easy road to follow, especially where there are determined foes to try to block it. But the bottom line is that the political climate has improved. We are on the offensive now, and this field will move forward to bring treatments sooner than later. Thank you. I left something out. My next thing that I want to show you. In the UN campaign, my group was involved at the creation.
Should the United Nations recommend a treaty?
Not yet. Okay. You're going to see something in a minute if we can get it loaded right. Okay. I have to tell you about this because it was perhaps the searing moment for me in this. When I was first getting involved, I found out that the United Nations was considering this world treaty. It wasn't well known. This was in 2003 that was the move. This was the Bush administration and the Vatican were backing this. Essentially, they had presented the same Dr. David Prentice from the Family Research Council to the United Nations as an expert. He became affiliated with the Costa Rican delegation, if you can imagine, and was lecturing the UN on this. Well, I had filed an initiative called the World Court Initiative to try to get the UN to submit to the International Court of Justice that reproductive cloning was a violation of human rights and international law, to preserve therapeutic cloning, to separate it. And I found out that the Bush administration was driving this agenda forward. Through this crazy treaty proposal, the Genetics Policy Institute essentially became the whistleblower to the world that this was being pushed through. And it was at that time that I met some of the heroes of the stem cell revolution, patients that were an online community that gathered together. One of them, one of my heroes, is Dr. Raymond Barglow, who's here, who's been associated with me through this journey for close to 5 years when we were fighting this in the UN. And it was the tail that wagged the dog. We were able to organize 35,000 fax letters to the United Nations. We were able to get the Coalition for Advancement of Medical Research of 100 organizations to weigh in on this. organized scientists and patients, and in October 2003 were able to save the research in the legal committee of the UN by a single vote. By a single vote. And if anyone tells you that one person or small group of people can't do something to influence society and change, I'm telling you, it can be done. And Ray and others like Don Reed, who was in the White House when President Obama signed that order, were right there when it happened. It was a tremendous thrill to see colleagues of mine for years to step up in the way in this battle. My group was asked to stage a science conference for the UN to teach the UN the difference between unethical reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning, this form of stem cell research, nuclear transfer. And we did that, bringing in some of the prominent researchers in, I think it was June 2004, and the treaty was permanently derailed, actually, in 2005. But I wanted a prominent advocate to speak on this subject. And, of course, I reached out to Christopher Reeve. And 5 months before his death, he invited me to his house. And he said, I'll never forget, he came to the door, and he could barely speak. He was clamped to the wheelchair. I call it like a Borg. It was almost overwhelming to see him. But we went into his study, and he commended me that I was going to stage this UN conference, and he had allowed me to tape him because he couldn't be there at the United Nations. And I brought up a film crew, and we went over a script together. And he had his assistant smooth down his sweater, and he put himself in the study and had looked in the monitor and had the books removed so they were all darker colors. And he did something in one take. It's a 3-minute video. And I was sitting 3 feet from him, having given up my law practice, having funded the Genetics Policy Institute for a year myself, had really put myself at risk as well. And it was one of the most moving things that I did, that he came forward and did this. This was played twice to the United Nations, at my conference, and then we did a patient's press conference at the United Nations. And it was 5 days after he had died, and this was shown again. So hopefully it'll play now that I've built it up. Thank you.
So my prayers are with you, and I hope.
That's the end.
I hope that you'll make.
Now, I've built it up, but this is technology. I'll hear Christopher's voice interrupt me in a minute. The public isn't aware on scientific issues, by and large. Skill sets as a trial attorney, we have to become experts in the narrow fields that we try, whether it's a construction defect case, a medical case. So to me, having the leading experts available to me, I was able to use the skill sets that I had to be an advocate for this. And it was some tough sledding on this. And it's only because people see this as a personal issue and it's something that might impact their lives that that there's a passion for it. When you realize some of the arguments that are used against it and talking points and how they seep their way into public policy, it's truly frustrating. But thank you for bringing that up. Are there any other questions or comments until Christopher interrupts us, if he does? Yes, ma'am.
Are there some types of stem cell that are still objected to?
Are there still stem cells that there are an objection to? Yeah. And indeed, just because President Obama lifted the funding restriction, the foes of embryonic stem cell research still have a moral objection to these cells being used and are going to do everything within their power to stop this research. And if I can embellish the philosophy or a way we can frame this issue for the better, it could be a work by a Harvard philosopher, Lewis Gannon, who wrote a book, The Morality of Embryo Use. Well, The Morality of Embryo Use is a little tough sledding to read, but Lou has written other things in scientific journals, and he has come up with the idea of the unenabled embryo, and that we should reframe this not from this perspective of the embryo, but the donor's intent. The donor's intent, so that if a couple that has created a spare embryo have chosen to donate that embryo to science, and with the proviso that it cannot be implanted in the womb, it's their choice. There cannot be a corresponding person to be developed. Does the state have the power to intervene in that private decision? If it can only be used for medical research, then, and otherwise, the embryo has no feelings. It's a microscopic dot. It can never be developed because no one can implant it into a womb. There's a moral imperative for the betterment of humanity to use this for research and potentially life-saving research. To reframe this issue, that might be a consensus that everyone can agree. They might, even if you elevate the status of the embryo, unless you're planning to block IVF and the way IVF is practiced and really create a societal revolution, it's so inconsistent to say that embryos that otherwise would never be in a womb cannot be utilized. The law has to deal with this issue in a practical way, and it's so interesting when you consider the moral status of embryos. The law does, where there are surplus embryos in custody cases, or I should say in divorce cases, the law doesn't use the best interest of the child criteria or best interest of the embryo in determining who gets the embryo. It's considered bailment or personal property. And so the law has had to deal with this as a practical matter right now. Sometimes the law has to do those things, but I think it projects what society thinks about it.
I have an article here written by Rob Stein, who you were mentioning, about stem cells from skin, and he's talking particularly about Parkinson's.
Yes.
And I have a personal interest in that, too. My sisters have Parkinson's. Is there really a future for using these skin stem cells and developing them into something that can help Parkinson's sufferers?
Using skin stem cells for this induced pluripotent cell stem cells is considered something very promising. Right now, they're promising for study. I mean, this has only come about in the last year. Many of these cells are created by using a virus to transmit genetic material or genes, and that virus is foreign. How could that be used for clinical trials? If the clinical trials for embryonic stem cell research took many, many years, it's even perhaps further out for iPS cells. Does it hold promise? Of course it holds promise. But we have to think about all those roadblocks in between from the research in the lab to getting it into people.
I don't understand it. It seems there's so much that could come out of this research. Why are the people so against it?
Why are people against it? If you believe that life begins at conception, a human being starts at conception, that means even in vitro fertilization, where you're creating these embryos, that those cells are a person, whether they're in a woman's womb, growing in one day into a fetus or not, or just cells. And some folks go as far as to say that if you discard these embryos, it's murder. Well, you're going to be taking, at least on embryonic stem cells, the embryo is destroyed when you extract the stem cells. And that's the bottom line. If you feel that these embryos are people, it's a moral divide. You have to see if you can find a new consensus. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. The cord blood? Yeah, their cord blood is rich in blood stem cells, which is great, but it's not an alternative. It's something more with potential, and those cord blood is being used in some therapies and in treatments related to some blood cancers right now. It's more, but it's not a substitute. We need all of these tools.
You mentioned that there's a lot being developed overseas, and in particular, I've been reading a lot about what's being developed at the Hadassah Hospital in Israel. Could you comment on that?
Well, Israel considers this a very great priority. And I know a couple of researchers there, Benjamin Rubinoff, who's doing work with embryonic cells and Parkinson's, although I like to say I'm Bernie Siegel, the lawyer, not the doctor, so I'm not the best qualified person in my organization to comment, other than I know it's very promising. Another, Rafi Gorodetsky, has come up with something called microbeads that are used as a growth factor on scaffolds to help use those decellularized organs and grow tissue with stem cells. So, you know, Hadassah is a first-rate institution.
Yeah, could you broaden the discussion a little bit more? You mentioned the UN, United Nations, and its role. You're organizing conferences. There are conferences all over the world all the time. What is the alignment that you're seeing among the member countries of the UN now? Where are the, I mean, obviously there are institutions like in Israel or in Mexico or in China or Russia or Japan or wherever that are advocating this. What is the alignment of the countries, and what has the WHO, the World Health Organization, or other UN bodies done with their experts to become advocates, or are they neutral in these things?
I would say largely the WHO is on the sidelines on this, and the United Nations is certainly at this point on the sidelines. It's sort of been removed from the debate, which is, believe me, better. If you think Congress is a mess trying to pass a world treaty, you don't want to know from that. But as far as the world, you'll find in Europe, in the UK, in Sweden, Spain, Portugal, this research is truly moving forward at a rapid rate. Germany recently eased some of its restrictions on embryonic stem cell research, though not all. There's a problem that, a broader problem, that countries and states can opt out. Like the European Union has rules to allow embryonic stem cell research, but certain countries can opt out from it. We have the same problem in the United States now, where some states are trying to opt out. In Asia, China, Korea, Japan, Singapore, major research centers. In Israel, you'd be surprised to know that in the Middle East, and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, major investments are being made right now in stem cell laboratories and regenerative medicine. So, you know, certainly it's around the globe, India as well. Possibly the WHO is a venue, but I think we are working on a regional basis and country by country basis. Some do not have an appetite for this, and you know, I'm happy to see the countries that are supporting it move the field forward. As it develops, countries are going to see this as a major part of the biotechnology industry, and which is very important for economic development, and I think we'll see broader support. Yes, sir.
With regards to the embryos that are out there now, what are the numbers as far as the number of embryos that are out there, and then how many are being destroyed annually already? Are there numbers on that?
You know, someone told me today that about 7,000 annually are destroyed. I hadn't heard that before, but thousands are, I know. And I've been told that there are about 600,000 frozen embryos in the United States, that some of which could be donated to scientific research. Really, the person, a couple has a choice of what to do. They can donate it to research. They can see if it could be offered up for quote, adoption. I think there have been about 80 in history that that have happened. Or the doctor can make a choice what to do. You give it up, leave it up to the doctor. At least that's sometimes the offer, the decision that has to be made. So there was a great piece in the Huffington Post, a woman in last week, where a woman said that when faced with that choice, she would gladly see the embryos destroyed for the purpose of alleviating chronic disease. Not that this is an easy decision to make, by the way, and I don't suggest that it is, but we struggle as a society to put the fences in the right place on all of our behavior, including scientific research. But I would rather this fence be placed where we might be able to cure some of these chronic diseases. Do we have time to show the video? Are you able to do it? No? All right. Are you able to do it? We have... Okay. Another question. Go ahead.
So this is a related question. So in vitro fertilization, you are inevitably going to be creating embryos that are going to die at some point in the process. So either they won't be healthy enough and they'll die on their own, or they're not going to implant. And you're also creating vast amount of excess embryos. So if you consider that these embryos already have a person, the status of a person, then we have technically about, 400,000 people in long-term storage and people dying every day in this process. How come the moral outrage doesn't begin with this process? I've never been able to wrap my head around how the distinction between being outraged at embryos dying in research versus embryos dying during in vitro fertilization.
I appreciate so much the comment. When I debate the foes of the research, I confront them with that point. I once engaged in a discourse with a very prominent UK philosopher, bioethicist, who was opposed to the research. And I said, why don't you ever discuss the societal implications? Because basically you're going to shut down the IVF industry. All abortions, of course, are going to be banned with this. You're going to be giving rights to microscopic dots of cells. It's going to change the way society runs. And he said, well, you know, let the heavens fall, which was, I think, someone's famous quote about slavery. Well, this is not slavery. And there are societal implications to it. And I think it's outrageous that the foes of the research can hold up a slide saying adult stem cells 72, embryonic stem cell research, nothing. They get away with that. But then not to drive home the point about what society would look like with this philosophy as law and what it would mean for individuals and the rights of privacy. To me, it's a true outrage. Don't get me started.
I have one brief question. What's the significance of the outlook for stem cells? What do you see in the future, 10, 20, 30 years? What will we be able to cure? What will we be able to do?
You know, we live in the information age, and we live in the time of the sequencing of the human genome. This is a paradigm shift, all right, where we can use possibly cell therapies or understand the root causes of disease. Some, perhaps optimists, see this as really a way to cure aging. If you follow Aubrey de Grey in Ending Aging, an interesting guy who thinks this is a fundamental tool that we might extend the human lifespan. I scratch my head and say, well, you know, is this only going to be for the elite or the rich that might be able to do it as the rest of the world falls into grinding poverty and the greatest depression of all time? Who knows in 20 or 30 years? But I will say this research is hugely promising. I think it will uncover the root causes of several diseases and lead to cures of several chronic problems and diseases for which no cure is known. And whatever the number it is, it's going to be a great benefit to mankind.
It's always occurred to me that the basis for all the objections to embryonic stem cell research really arise from one point. And that is, everybody knows that conception takes place when a man provides a sperm and a woman provides an ovum, and they get together and they start to develop. The people who object to embryonic stem cell research believe that also at the same time a supernatural entity provides a soul. And if you believe that the soul is there from the very beginning, well, it is a human being, because if you define humanity as the possession of a soul, then by circular reasoning, you're there. Now, why don't we simply argue that people who think that there is a soul and the soul defines humanity and the soul is there from the moment of conception should simply exit themselves from all the advantages of stem cell research, but leave to everybody else the advantages and benefits which come from this, because they don't believe in that particular definition of humanity.
I think that's a pretty good idea. If we can, 3 minutes to show this video. We'll see if it works, and if it doesn't, I'll come back another time.
First, I want to thank my friend Bernie Siegel and his remarkable organization, the Genetics Policy Institute, for arranging this very important conference at the United Nations. And I'm very sorry that I can't be there in person. Now, as representatives to the UN, all of you hold positions of enormous responsibility. You are perceived as the voice not only of the countries you represent, but as the collective moral voice of the world. Millions of patients just like me will be watching with great concern as you continue your important deliberations. Everyone I know of, including the scientists you'll hear from today, opposes the cloning of babies and the pursuit of reproductive cloning. But every leading scientist seeking cures calls for stem cell research to advance. Therapeutic cloning, also known as somatic cell nuclear transfer, offers real hope. The research is still in its infancy, but it has so much promise. And not to encourage the ethical pursuit of this research might result in needless human suffering and destroy the hope of those afflicted with Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, spinal cord injuries, and a host of other conditions for which no cure is yet known. Countries around the world are grappling with this issue and deciding that the purpose of government is to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Countries can ban reproductive cloning and still live up to their obligation to provide the best medical technology to all citizens. And I have a real concern that a great medical advance might be lost to humanity should the United Nations recommend a treaty that would prohibit this research. So my prayers are with you, and I hope that you'll make the right decision. A decision based on secular law and morally sound scientific knowledge that will provide hope to millions suffering all over the world. Thank you very much.
Somehow that was made more poignant to me, that the screen went blank. If it was played correctly, the screen went white. But while I apologize that that was a glitch in the video, I think you got the message. Thank you.
Our thanks to Mr. Bernie Siegel for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.